Okay, gather round, people of Deep River Tribe. It being day 91 since the shiny man come and took the power grid down, tonight we all eat the nice wild dog and zebra muscle. Now time for all story told by mouth and puppet figure show. Tonight I tell the story of how Mariska Hargitay catch the bad man kill cab taxi driver.
Oh, no, not that one. No.
Story sucks.
No, this best puppet good parley ever. Mr. Clever, Jackie Jack McCoy in the end comes and turn all the lights back on.
Is this the episode that had Tom Skerritt as a guest star?
No, Bradley Cooper, before he be Mr. Famous Man.
I have a question.
Speak it then, Greg the Barrel Maker.
We've only been without electricity for 3 months. Why have we descended to a point where we speak a pigeon dialect, and nothing remains of religion or literacy except vague shamanism? And a cult organized around Punch and Judy shows.
Fair parley, Mr. Barrelman. Now come a talk where they used to say radio. Old cranky man who pooped too close to the river say these facts to you. His name? Colin McEnroe.
Well, thanks very much, and I'm concerned, obviously. I'm concerned about that future scenario. We are going to be talking today about power failures, but not the kinds of power failures you're used to, even though you think you're used to really terrible power failures. You've seen it here in Connecticut even this year, where a Con Ed problem in New York significantly crippled the ability of Metro North to operate Connecticut to New York. That took 12 days to fix. It wasn't even that big a deal, I mean, in terms of what can happen to power. But it took 12 days to fix. That tells you that that power problems can be difficult to correct. You think it's just a matter of the trucks coming by and doing something to your transmission lines. Sometimes not. We've been through things like the October snowstorm of 2011, when 800,000, more than 800,000 customers in Connecticut lost power for a while. 150,000 of them still didn't have power after a week. That's nothing compared to what we're about to talk about. We're going to talk also about what happens when grid failures cascade, as they did in 2003. Something started in Ohio. It cascaded, a term I don't even really completely understand, even as it escapes my mouth, but cascaded east towards the East Coast, knocking out, I think, a total of about 50 million people's power. So how can that happen? And how bad could it get? And how vulnerable is the electrical grid? In a couple of minutes, you're going to meet Richard Andres. He is a professor of national security strategy at National War College and a consultant for American Blackout, a two-hour movie event on the National Geographic Channel this Sunday. Also, a little bit later, we'll talk to Brian Harrell. He's with the North American Electrical Reliability Corporation, known as NERC. They're going to do a drill in November that will simulate a large-scale attack on the power grid. We'll talk a little bit about how that happens and what kinds of industries are interrelated, even if the industry isn't based anywhere within the outage. What else gets touched by all that? We're going to start with somebody who's been looking at a lot of these questions. Matthew Wald is an environmental reporter for the New York Times. I would say parenthetically that roughly 75 years ago, he and I were together covering the state capitol here in Hartford. But he's been doing a lot of other interesting work since then. Matt's been looking a lot at the electrical grid, the so-called glass jaw of American industry. Matt Wald, welcome back to Connecticut.
Thank you, Colin. Yeah, it was we worked together, let's see, it was after the dinosaurs, but before the glaciers receded, right?
Something along those lines.
Right.
The glaciers and our hairlines, actually.
Right.
First of all, maybe it would help to sort of define terms. I think we talk about things like power grid or power grids, and I know that I don't really know what I'm talking about when I say that. So what does that even mean?
What it means is that in the second half of the last century, all the utilities interconnected with each other so they could swap small amounts of power. And if you had, the bigger the system got, in a way, the safer it was if you had one power plant go down, but you were connected through a web, this is pre-internet, but a web of power lines, then the system would continue running through minor upsets. But it also raised the stakes. It created the ability for one failure to—it's like ice skaters who are linking arms. If one of them stumbles and the others don't, nobody falls down. But it's possible one of them will stumble and tear down all of them, and they'll all fall over. And that's the trade-off of part of the trade-off of the grid.
So, and is that what we mean when we say, use the word cascade? You'll see a description of, in fact, what did happen in August of 2003,
right,
when a power failure took a few moments to go from Detroit to New York. Is that what a cascade is? And what's happening when it cascades? Is it that line of skaters?
There was an imbalance between supply and demand. It's like a house of cards, and it's designed to withstand a failure here or a failure there. In that particular case, a utility in Ohio had a computer that shut down. They didn't know it had shut down. They were no longer keeping their eyes on what power lines were operating and what were not, what generators were operating and what were not. They lost track of things. They ended up with this huge imbalance. And as they fell down, they pulled others down with them, including part of Connecticut.
You know, I mean, so in a sense, the irony here is, and I was reading something about a study done by some Israeli mathematicians, I think, of this, that something that's randomized, something that's assembled without much design, or something that accretes using a fairly chaotic set of patterns,
right,
it has a hardiness that something that's intentionally designed might not have, because the thing that's intentionally designed does have a nexus here and a crux there, right?
Well, yes, and the grid actually was not thoroughly designed. It began as, in 1900 or so, individual cities having their own electric systems and finally linking themselves together and becoming more and more tightly linked. The grid is actually set up to tolerate failure. If you look at New England, for example, there's somebody sitting out in West Springfield, Mass, at a control center, who is looking at each moment at what is the biggest link on my system, the biggest generator, the biggest power line, and if it fails, will the whole system go down? And that operator has designed, set up the system, set up what's generating and what isn't, so it will survive that biggest failure. So the grid does not go down very often, but it can. And almost all of this system is designed without a whole lot of thought to bad actors coming in. If you come in and you want to cause a blackout, you would have some difficulty because you've got a system that's designed to be fault tolerant. On the other hand, if you start to mess around with it with computers, you may be able to do lots of things at once that's more than the system can cope with. And in fact, you could do some things that would not only turn out the lights, that cause physical damage to the transformers or the generating equipment. And then not only would you be in the dark, but it would take you a long time to recover and get running again.
What does a long time mean?
Well, a lot of the components on the grid in the United States are no longer manufactured in the United States. There are people who say, I'm not 100% certain this is correct, but there are people who say, we could lose some big transformers, things that change the voltage. They boost electricity up to high voltages for long-distance transmission and bring it back down to lower voltages for local distribution, that you could take months to have to replace, and in the interim, you'd have trouble running the system. You'd have limited amounts of electricity. The nice part of the 2003 blackout, which was fairly miserable, was that we didn't do any damage to hardware, so things were able to start up again fairly promptly. The movie you mentioned, American Blackout, posits a cyber disruption so bad that transformers start to burst into flames. And if you get to the point where you've got big transformers in that category, then you could, in fact, do permanent damage. I don't think the public understands after a blackout, the engineers come out and say, well, yeah, you've been in the dark for 48 hours, but it was successful because we didn't do any damage. But they're serious about that.
And there's so many ways in which we've gotten little hints of this. As I said, you know, if it can take 12 days to fix a relatively minor problem compared to what we're talking about at Con Ed and get Metro North back up and running at full steam, it almost kind of gives you at least a little sense of what would happen if something intentional and much worse went on. Now, when we hear about this, and we'll talk to all of our guests about this a little bit, but first of all, I wouldn't have to walk too far away from where I'm sitting right now to find somebody who, on an amateur basis, thinks about this a lot, you know, and when you talk to people like this, you hear basically about three different things. You hear about what you just talked about, some kind of cyber terrorism, something that uses computers to screw up the power distribution system. You also hear about an electromagnetic pulse that somehow or other intentionally detonated.
Right.
Maybe you have terrorists who explode at a low level some kind of nuclear device that releases an electromagnetic pulse. And you hear about solar flares. No bad guys this time, but just things that the sun can do, pulses from the sun that can do this. Are these all the same kind of problem that just needs to be sort of looked at strategically different ways, or are these all different problems?
They're not the same, but defenses against one could be helpful in defending against the other. Mm-hmm. Quebec has actually had blackouts because of solar activity. What happens, roughly speaking, is the sun sends out charged particles in a continuous wave forever. It's not the sunspot itself, but associated with the sunspot, the density of those particles changes. Those interact with the Earth's magnetic field, and the Earth's magnetic field changes shape a little bit. And if you remember high school physics, the way you make electricity is running a magnetic field through a conductor. It turns out that some of the Earth's crust is a conductor. And if you move the magnetic field through granite rock, you can generate currents in the ground, and those currents can collect on the grid and damage things. So you get transformer damage, and you get power plants knocked offline. EMP, is electromagnetic pulse, is somewhat similar. If you explode a nuclear weapon, 1 or 2% of the energy is released as an electromagnetic pulse. That pulse is gathered up in the power lines as if the power lines were antennas, and it's concentrated, and it can fry equipment. The NBC movie of, it must be 20 years ago now, the Day After, it begins with all the cars breaking down and even people's wristwatches stopping because of electromagnetic pulse. How bad exactly that could be is not clear, but there are a lot of people worried that if a bad actor who had only one or two or three nuclear weapons might choose to use them by crippling the power grid.
Those are all worrisome, but it does feel as though, reading your coverage, some of the other coverage, even listening to what you said in the early going of this conversation, as though the real immediate threat is through computers. And the New York Times Bits blog just quite recently wrote about these two guys, these two engineers who are not security specialists. This is not what they think about for a living. But they just sort of started messing around with a certain kind of program that interacts with the power grid and couldn't, as they went from system to system, couldn't find anything they couldn't break. And their description of this suggests that you wouldn't need to be the greatest expert in the world in all this to find a flaw in it. Do you have a sense of how vulnerable that part of the glass jaw is?
Well, you know, as they say here in Washington, I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you. No, and I suspect that the industry doesn't really know either. The industry has made some strides. It has recognized itself and been recognized by the federal government, especially after things like Hurricane Sandy, that it is the keystone of our comfort. Everything from telephones to water to sewage, et cetera, the ability to refrigerate food, it all comes down to electricity. Some of the systems are insulated. They're not connected to the World Wide Web. But as time goes on and the you get smart meters, you get other aspects of the smart grid, the grid does get more computerized. You could worry about an insider, you know, a guy who wasn't quite an insider. He was a contractor, an Edward Snowden type. There are abilities to cope with this stuff. The drill that you mentioned that's coming up next month, run by the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, they did one 2 years ago. They had a few dozen participants. They're going to do one now. They'll have hundreds of participants. And it's an effort not to see how vulnerable they are, but to see if your computer system gets knocked down, how fast can you get it put back together and get things running again? And that's a major focus right now.
You know, the question comes up, who knows about this and who thinks about this? One thing that you've reported on, Matt, is that not one, I think, but actually two former members of Congress have thought about this, at least in a fictional setting. Newt Gingrich, quite a few years ago, I think, wrote a novel about something along these lines. And then you wrote about the fact that Byron Dorgan, a former senator, also is writing about this. Something that they know walking up and down those halls, something that they've heard about, has told them that this is not all that far-fetched.
Gingrich wrote a preface to a novel called One Second After, and that novel has become a sort of right-wing rallying cry that we're not doing enough to protect ourselves against the possibility of somebody taking a simple Scud missile and a small warhead and exploding it at high altitude over the United States and doing severe damage, lasting damage to the power grid. Byron Dorgan's two novels, they're sort of techno-thrillers. He had a co-author, David Hagberg, center on energy research and hackers backed by the Russians who come in and blackmail the United States by knocking down the grid. This is not to say that he's an engineer or understands exactly how feasible this is, but it's clearly to say that it is now the focus of a lot of anxiety.
You know, in your sense, in covering this, we're talking to Matt Walfra, he's an environmental reporter for the New York Times, as you cover this out of D.C., reading your coverage, I get a sense that people know about this and understand about this. One of the things that I'm less clear about is it the case that a lot of people in decision-making positions within government, within the power industry, are thinking about this on a regular basis, or is there the equivalent of one or two Richard Clark figures, you know, pre-9/11, just, you know, a few guys walking around within the justice and intelligence communities saying, you know, Al-Qaeda is really a lot more dangerous than you think, and, you know, one of the things they might do is XYZ. Is it like that, just a few voices talking about that, or is there a clamor about this problem?
Well, at this point, there's a clear realization that we may be vulnerable, and there's a lot of work, coordination, partly spurred by Sandy, actually, about what the government could do in case of massive grid disruption to help the utilities get back on their feet. Make some use of military facilities, be relieved from some regulatory burdens. Sandy was a mess. In Sandy's case, Hydro-Quebec tried to send some linemen down into the New York area to help, and they got to the border and TSA wouldn't let them through. There's clearly the ability to trip all over yourself and make things worse, and we're now exploring those and trying to find ways around them. In the cyber area, the federal government, the Obama administration, has a major push on what they call critical infrastructure to try to assess what the vulnerabilities are, how to reduce those vulnerabilities, and how to set yourself up for recovery after. Essentially, I don't know, Colin, if you've ever had your email hacked or you discovered your bank had its system hacked and you can't pay your bills online. Essentially, we all face this at some low, annoying level. The question is, it's like asymmetric warfare. It's somebody with limited visibility, maybe no return address, who manages to penetrate and cause damage. At this point, you'd have to say we are quite aware of that possibility and working on what can be done about it.
Well, Matt Wild, you've been generous with your time, but now it's time for you to get back and figure out how to save us from this. But it's great to talk to you again. It makes up for the fact that I stole your stapler in the Capitol press room.
I remember that.
Yeah, right, I knew you did. All right, so anyway, we'll talk to you again really soon. Thanks for joining
us.
All right, bye-bye. Matt Wild from the New York Times. I do want to say in our next segment, if you want to call in, I didn't say this at the beginning, but if you want to call in, if you have your observations or your questions, or if you're a solar flare theorist, we'd be happy to hear from you. 860, we know you exist. 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Coming back into the next segment, we'll be talking to Richard Andrus. He's a professor of national security strategy at the National War College. He was a consultant to the movie that Matt was just talking about, American Blackout, a two-hour movie event on the National Geographic Channel this Sunday. Freestyling in the dark, I said, let's rock this thing like a cypher. I don't need stage light, just get out your lighters. I'll rap in a power outage, don't need a microphone, I can rap without it. Let me scream, don't have none left. As I said, in this segment, we're going to be talking to Richard Andrus. Professor Richard Andrus is from the National Security Strategy Department at the National War College. He was a consultant for American Blackout, this two-hour movie event on the National Geographic Channel this Sunday, 8 p.m. So, Richard Andrus, we've been talking to Matt Wald from the New York Times about the vulnerability of the grid, the things that can happen. I guess my first question to you is, as when you think about this, do you think about it as an if, or do you think about it as a when?
Well, yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for coming.
So let me start out with how I sort of walked into this. About 5 years ago, the Department of Homeland Security came and asked if I would host a war game here at National Defense University, an exercise looking at this, because we were trying to figure out just how likely something like this was to happen. And so we spent a lot of time, we had a lot of experts in here talking to us about what they thought could or would happen. And we put this down as a very low probability, but a very high impact event. So the point being is that it was not very likely to happen, but if it did happen, the impact would be big enough that we couldn't just not think about it.
So an if rather than a when. And then when we talk about this happening, what in your mind is the this?
Well, we walked through a lot of scenarios. So the question is, first of all, you know, in the movie, it's a cyber attack that takes down the electric grid, and it's for 10 days. So when we've exercised this, there are different actors that might want to take down the U.S. electric grid. They might be a sole hacker wanting to do this for thrills. It could be a terrorist group. It could be a political activist group. It could be a nation state. You know, it could be a major power nation state. So it really depends on who is trying to do it. And so once you think about who's trying to do it, then you can backward induce and try to figure out what kind of capabilities they have. So if you're talking about a small group or a single guy, the odds are they probably couldn't do a lot of damage. They might take down a single plant or a single area for a short period of time. But at the other end of the spectrum, you know, if a major power like Russia or China decided to put their mind behind it, my best guess would be they could take out most of the U.S. electric system for a very long period of time, possibly for months. So, you know, but the good thing is that major powers are deterred. You know, I can't see Russia or China, you know, waking up one day and deciding that they want to destroy the economy of the United States.
On the other hand, could you see Iraq, having been through the Stuxnet computer worm that took out 20% of their centrifuges, can you see them waking up some morning and thinking, well, how would you like a taste of your own medicine?
Well, see, this is the unknown part of this, and this is the part that is worrying all of us. And that is, 5 years ago when we did this, we said only a major power could do anything on this catastrophic continental-wide scale to our electric grid. But what happened since then is Stuxnet came out, people have decompiled it, and so it's gotten a lot easier now. People have figured out how this works, and now what we don't know, what I certainly don't know, is, you know, what kind of state could do something like this? Has it changed enough now that a state, a mid-sized state like Iran, might have the capability to really hurt our electric grid quite badly? And I don't have the answer to that, and I don't think anybody else does either. But you can imagine if the United States were to engage in a military conflict with Iran, you can imagine Iran, as their regime feels like it's going down and they have nothing to lose, if they did have a capability like this, I don't think there would be anything that would stop them from using it.
I want to come back to the question of capability. I'm also being told by the producers that I said Iraq. Obviously, I meant Iran. But well, actually, while we're on the subject of the capability, and I brought this up with Matt Wald, too, the whole issue of the vulnerability of the grid to some kind of cyber invasion. You probably saw the same thing that I did in the Bits blog column in the New York Times just a few days ago. These two engineers who didn't really have a whole lot of background in security were nonetheless able to get past or break, as they said, pretty much anything they tried to break, almost at any power facility they went after. And they were just doing it as an exercise. It makes you think, and I'm sure you know a lot more about this, that a lot of this stuff isn't as cyber secure as it really ought to be.
Yeah, we have a really
serious national security problem here. You know, for very good reasons, the electric grid of the United States is independently owned. It's privately owned, and that's the reason power is so cheap in this country. So there's good reasons for this, and the power companies are extremely jealous of their autonomy, and, you know, they want to keep rates low, and they do that by not spending money on things like protecting themselves from a cyber attack by a major outside actor. So, you know, I mean, all right, I get it. It makes sense. But the problem is that because they're not spending that money to address this type of threat, because their economic incentive is to be efficient and save money, they truly are not very well prepared for something like this. And, yeah, a lot of independent hackers and small groups have proven conclusively they can get into individual power plants and individual electric transmission companies and mess with their SCADA infrastructure. So, you know, the big question here is, you know, what would it take not to take out one plant or three or four, but to take out enough plants to start cascades that would take out U.S. infrastructure for a long period of time? Probably, my guess is it still couldn't be done by a small group of engineers. It would take a very large-scale effort, you know, if not on the scale of a nation state, then a very, very sophisticated group of hackers to do that. So I think it's still difficult to do. But, you know, we've seen time and again that it can be done on a small scale.
We're talking to Richard Andrews. He's a professor of national security strategy at the National War College, consultant for American Blackout, a movie event on the National Geographic Channel this Sunday. We don't even have to say that it can be, that maybe something of that level, of that magnitude, we can talk about whether it can be done. But in terms of sort of just getting into power industry systems, that's not speculative, right? I mean, there's malware in some of these systems already. They're not shutting systems down. They're not causing grid cascades, but they're making equipment slow down and not operate right, correct?
Well, so this year, this has been very difficult for guys like me to get a handle on, because the private industry, and the last thing you ever want to do if you are hacked is talk about it publicly. It's going to hurt your stock prices. It's going to make you more vulnerable to future intrusion. So you keep this, you know, completely locked up. Nobody talks about it. But CSIS did this. That's a think tank here in town in Washington. They did a real interesting thing. They did an anonymous survey of energy executives around the world. And the results of that survey came back, and it was absolutely shocking. That was this year. They found that two-thirds of industry executives said their company had discovered malware on their systems designed to sabotage their systems. So this is pervasive. I mean, this software, this malware is absolutely globally. It's been injected onto systems. The question is, who is doing this? Why are they doing it? Because someone's spending a lot of time and energy to try to put that malware on systems around the world and on U.S. SCADA infrastructure. The question is, why are they doing it? And, you know, what should we be doing right now to prepare for it?
The two guys that I read about, one of them is named Crane. One of the things that became clear to me reading about them is that they didn't have any really special access. In other words, they weren't anybody. They weren't connected to anybody. They were basically on the internet. They were on the internet, and they were somehow they're able to approach on the internet these utilities and get into software that was controlling and monitoring substations and control centers and stuff like that, which means that it's all kind of hooked up to the internet. I mean, it seems odd anyway that something that important and that theoretically vulnerable has a path leading up to it that almost anybody could walk up at least some of. Could you talk about that a little bit?
It is. And for years now, you know, anybody that's been looking at this has said we have to disconnect our electrical SCADA infrastructure, our electrical infrastructure from any access to the internet. That's not a surefire cure, right? Because you can still get malware onto systems indirectly through using thumb drives and other methods. But, you know, it's a 90% solution. We need to disconnect that electrical infrastructure from the internet. You know, it's a no-brainer, but the problem is that it costs money. If you have to hire people to do things that right now you can do from a central location really easily, it's just really efficient. Nobody wants to spend the extra money to hire the extra bodies to take care of these things that you can do so efficiently with computers, you know, over the internet. But, you know, what's got to happen And I'm hoping that it's going to happen soon. I mean, I've been you know, invited to give talks to industry all over the country, you know, to Congress, to the labs here. So, you know, I feel like there's a groundswell going on. But, you know, we've got to understand that there is a price to pay. There's a large risk that you pay for that efficiency. And although you might be making a little more money now, taking a risk with something this large is not a good idea. So I'm hoping that what comes out of this, you know, this sort of groundswell that we're getting on this subject is that at the very minimum, we get our utility companies and electric transmission companies to disconnect their systems completely from the Internet. That's, you know, that's the bottom line. That's a no-brainer. That's the easy solution. That's where we got to start.
But you can sort of, as you're talking, I can see the seductiveness of the way things are. You know, this summer we were doing a show about drive-in movies, and we were at a drive-in movie, which was full of digital equipment. And the guy who runs it said, you know, I can actually start a movie or even focus the movie on the screen using my phone. You know, I could be somewhere else. I can just take my, he has a regular old smartphone, and he can focus the movie on the screen. He could be, you know, a town away and still do that. And I'm thinking, obviously, it's not that simple or not that porous a membrane for the power grid. But we're really talking about the same thing, right? It's great to be able to access stuff. It's great to be able to not have to physically go to a place and do something, you know, turn a dial. It's great to be able to do it digitally and from a platform that's located far away. That's what they're having such a hard time giving up.
That's exactly right. I mean, we're all doing this, and of course, you know, I heard you mention earlier that on your personal computer, you know you're going to get hacked occasionally, and it's worth the risk. You know, somebody's going to get into your email, somebody's going to put malware on your system, it's going to pop up ads on your computer or who knows what. But we're willing to take that risk because it only affects us personally. And if somebody gets into those things, and even if the worst case scenario happens and someone hacks through your computer into your bank account and makes a withdrawal, that's still your personal risk. But you know what's going on here is this isn't personal. If they get into your power company and they can surge power through your lines, it's not just going to be your power company that gets hurt. It's going to be your subscribers within your region. And it's not just them either, because there's a potential that you're going to create a cascade that's going to take out your region. You know, so you're talking about very big costs. You know, and one of the real fundamental problems that we're encountering here is we've got about 1,500 different organizations which own what we call the North American power grid. And we've got more than 50 different states and regions that are regulating this. So everybody wants to put the cost off on someone else and get the benefits for themselves. How do you get that many organizations to come together and say, listen, we've got a problem here, and we've got to all chip in by disconnecting as much as possible from these vulnerable Internet-based systems, these SCADA systems, and pay that price so that we can have security for the whole electric grid.
We've got a call from another Richard. I'm going to go to it in just a second here, but as long as we're talking about that. So 1,500 different entities involved somehow in this. And, you know, one of the things we do know about anything like this is the human factor becomes important at a certain point. You can design and design and design, and then ultimately your work gets handled by human beings. And I don't know how much of a chance you've had to look at this or how much information you can collect about this, but my guess is that once human beings get involved, they get a little lazy about things like passwords.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The password situation is, you know, I saw a demonstration recently where a person who specializes in hacking passwords demonstrated that he could hack the vast majority, something like 90% of passwords, in about 3 seconds. So, you know, passwords are not terribly secure. People reuse the same passwords. They use the sorts of passwords everyone else is using. They use the same password for lots of different applications. One of the most egregious things we see in the power grid is people will buy stock equipment, and they'll attach it to their infrastructure, and they'll leave the factory password on it. So, you know, across the United States, there are lots and lots of different pieces of the grid that have factory installed passwords, which of course you can go online and Google and get in one stroke, and then you can use those to get into that infrastructure. It's a matter of people don't want to spend the time and effort to secure this. It's just, you know, it's efficient, it's comfortable, and until somebody shows these guys that there is a threat out there, it's going to continue on exactly the way it's going right now.
We're talking to Richard Andrews. He's professor of national security. I can't say it. National Security Strategy of the National War College. I'm getting so scared. One of the things. This may be a little bit outside what you've been looking at, and if so, forgive me. But one conversation that I've had several times with one of our disaster experts has to do with copper phone lines, and I've been reading recently about situations where Verizon and other companies, as they repair damaged phone lines damaged during Sandy or anything else, are taking copper out and replacing it with other more wireless friendly systems. And I'm wondering if you've thought a little bit about that kind of thing. I mean, because what I've been told is when the power goes out, if it's copper, if you've got sort of a regular old phone set and it's copper all the way back to the station, it'll actually work, even if there's no power. But everything else is completely electric dependent. I mean, is that another thing we need to think about, is how many things we have that are like that, that just sort of don't work in a power outage?
Well, that's an excellent example right there. Is the old plain old telephone system was designed to be very, very resilient in the face of some sort of a catastrophe. So it rerouted, and you could keep power on. You recall your landline probably worked even when the power was out in your neighborhood when you were growing up. Well, as we've moved to these digital interfaces where everything goes through a internet service provider like AT&T or whatever, when the power goes down and those big ISPs go down, everyone's telephone goes down. But, that's just the tip of the iceberg, because, of course, our banking systems are 100% dependent on the Internet now. So you lose power to the Internet, and banking stops. Almost all stores now, if you walk down to your local store, if the power goes out, their cash registers don't work, and they'll shut the doors. They can't do business for cash anymore. Not that anyone carries cash anymore. So when the electricity goes down, you lose finance, you lose commerce. A large portion of the water supply across the country is electrically pumped now, instead of just be gravity drained like it used to be. So again, after the power goes out, you've got if you live in one of those areas, you've got until the tank empties out, and then you lose water as well. So we've become completely dependent on electricity as a life support system in a way that we weren't even 20 years ago.
Let me grab a call from, but I think we discovered that also during 2011, that gas pumps went out faster than they used to.
The gas pumps will go out. The instant the energy, the electricity goes out, your gas pumps will stop pumping, except in Florida, where they legislated a chain of gas stations that had to have their own electricity supplies in case of hurricanes.
All right, so just drive to Florida and you can get some
That's
gas.
Right.
All right, let's have a kind of a Richard to Richard question here. This is Richard from Southbury. Go ahead, Richard.
Yes, this is a kind of different slant on things, but since publicly owned electric utilities are regulated on a state-by-state basis, usually by utility commissions, and these commissions approve the return on investment paid to the investors. Most people know that utilities pay a higher dividend than, say, another type of investment, just because they're publicly regulated and they can only spend so much on equipment. Otherwise, if they spend more money, then it decreases the dividends paid to their stockholders. So the question to the utility commission is, how much should be allowed to put into protective equipment, which protect us from these, in part, from these outages?
Yeah, and that's going to differ state by state. I don't know, Richard Andrews, if you have anything comprehensive to say about that. My sense is that any place that has had a protracted outage or, a real grand slam kind of outage here in Connecticut in 2011, we had 800,030 customers out. I think in Sandy was similar to that. The more of those kinds of things you have, I would assume the more amenable your public utility control commissioners are to the idea of those expenditures.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. And what this gets down to is the bottom line is it's up to, this is a democracy, And it's going to be up to voters to either solve this problem or not solve the problem. If they don't care about it, the local regulatory body is not going to care about it. And if they don't care about it, the utility companies aren't going to care about it. So it's got to start from the grassroots if it's going to have any traction. Which might sound a little bit funny coming from a guy who's been working for the Department of Defense and the federal government, but. That's the conclusion I've come to.
All right. Well, it's good to know there's a populist there. Richard Andrus, great to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it. When we come back, you might be wondering, well, shouldn't we drill for this? I mean, shouldn't we prepare for it? It turns out we actually do, and we're gonna.
There was no power for cooking, so we all learned to cook by fire.
All right, it is really dark in here. I don't know if I can read the credits. This shop was produced by Atrix Staphill, Blackie Keplin, and Mice. Our inert was Gargit Koppelman. The part of Biff Murray was laid by Eddie Kilowog. Tomorrow in the Nays. I can't read this. Just go back to the show.
All right, we have a little bit of a power problem here, a little bit of an illumination issue, but nothing compared to what absolutely could happen. So we are going to talk to the person who's preparing us, or who is at least going to drill a lot of these utilities on the kinds of things we're talking about right now. Brian Harrell is with the North American Electric Reliability Corporation. I find it reassuring even that there is such a thing. I like that word, reliability, known as NERC. He's in charge of a drill in November that will simulate large-scale attacks on the power grid. So, Brian Harrell, first of all, welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thank you. Thanks for having me very much.
And so give us a sense. I suppose there are a lot of things that you don't want to tell us about what's going to happen in November. What can you tell us about what will happen in November?
Well, sure. The grid security exercise, or GridX, will actually take place on November 13th and 14th, and it's a large-scale security and emergency response exercise. I should probably start by mentioning that this will be a simulated scenario with absolutely no operational impact to, you know, generation, transmission, or distribution of electric power. Absolutely no utility customers will be without power. The two-day event will simulate basically a coordinated physical and cybersecurity attack that damages the bulk power system and causes widespread outages. Currently, we have about 200 organizations from the electricity sector and some invited government partners that are participating, really including organizations in the United States, Canada, and Mexico. So truly, this is a North American-wide exercise.
Obviously, you're not going to deprive people, as you said. The average person, or not even the above or below average person, is not going to experience an outage as a result of this. So, given that, how can you measure what the impact would be? How will you know what kind of bullet effect all this would have?
Well, sure. This is a distributed play exercise. So if of these 200 organizations that are participating, they will be sitting behind their computers from whatever organization they are from, and they will be responding and going off of the different injects or materials or scenario snippets that we are providing them via email, and they are in turn responding to it. Now, because the exercise hasn't taken place, I need to refrain a little bit from talking about the scenario in too much detail. But, you know, at a high level, we're going to see some cyber attacks against some certain automated systems used by power system operators. We'll also see some coordinated physical attacks against key transmission substations and some generation facilities. These attacks will cause utilities to likely enact their crisis response plans and kind of walk through the internal security procedures that they have. The goals for the exercise really center around identifying potential improvements for their security plans, their programs, and their different responder skills that they have.
When you say,
I guess we'll want to review and encourage the communication of threat information within the electricity sector. We'll want to maintain constant situational awareness and keep really our government partners and national security partners apprised as the simulated scenario unfolds.
And that's a really great question. When things break, how well can people who are in key command positions talk to one another at different locations about the break? In other words, does the break disrupt communications? That's one of the questions you're asking.
Well, that's absolutely right. So we've done this exercise once already back in November of 2011. And, you know, the electricity sector has done a lot in the area of security, including, you know, implementing mandatory security standards, publishing a multitude, really, of security guidelines, and establishing great working relationships with the federal security and some of our intelligence partners. We've done this exercise once before, as I mentioned, and we want to continuously strive for better reliability and really get a feel for posing a challenging scenario against the industry. And we certainly think that this is a prime way to challenge the industry and ultimately, as we seek those lessons learned, to make the industry that much better.
Is compliance and cooperation pretty easy to obtain? You're seeing 205 utility companies. I think Richard Andres mentioned there ultimately maybe as many as 1,500 players in the 50 states. Does everybody say, okay, yeah, I'd like to try that drill? Do some people say...
Yeah, in 2011, I think there was a number of registered entities or utilities that were a bit apprehensive to play a security exercise with their regulator. But I think after they saw the value that the first GridX actually provided and some of the lessons learned and some of the real nuggets of information gold that came out of the exercise this time around, a lot more people have been much more willing to participate. As a matter of fact, this time around, we've really reached out to industry to try and pull in that expertise on scenario development. So really, it's been a great partnership between the federal government and industry, and of course us, both NERC and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, in trying to put together a realistic and timely scenario.
Do you look at sort of the interdependent industries? In other words, you know, obviously if there's a disruption of power, we know intuitively as power users, a lot of what's going to happen. The lights are going to go out. I won't be able to watch cable. My computer's not going to work. You know, things like that. On the other hand, there may be some gaming out of other stuff, industries that I wouldn't necessarily understand the way in which they'll be affected by a prolonged power outage. Have you looked at that as well?
We have, and we started to have those conversations early on. You know, I think potentially we can make this exercise really as big as you could possibly imagine it. So what we've tried to do is really try and scope and scale what it is that we're actually trying to test. And so this time around, we're having a more focused discussion, a more focused scenario on the physical security impact. Back in 2011, it was very much focused on the cyber impact that an attack would have. I do think that there is some real value as we move forward in the planning process, because we do this every 2 years. And so as we move forward to the next exercise, I think those interdependency issues of transportation, of water, of bringing that coal to generating plants, et cetera, I think there really is some interdependency issues that we can explore that will kind of highlight the fact that electricity is obviously dependent on other sectors other than itself. And then, of course, you know, you need electricity to do some of the things that you've just mentioned.
You know, you've mentioned sort of a couple times sort of the physical security threat or a simulated physical impact. So in this exercise you're doing in November, you're going to have, on the one hand, a cyber assault on power stations or on facilities related to power stations, but you're also going to simulate or pretend what, like ninjas with RPGs come and hit one of these things? Is that what we're talking about when we say physical?
Well, I think I'm gonna.
I don't mean for you to tip your hand or anything.
No, but I think we will have some generation and transmission facilities that may be attacked with some explosives, maybe some high powered rifles that damage key assets. Players will probably also experience an active shooter scenario develop as well. So what we're trying to do is really throw at our players or the participants on both the industry and the government side, kind of a worst case scenario, so that we can take the 1.5-2 days to really sit down, focus on if there are any potential gaps and some items for improvement that we may want to hone in on and improve upon. And I think at the end of the day, if we're taking a look at some of the physical issues combined with some of the cyber attacks that we've seen in the past, and try and make them realistic, I think the players will walk away thinking, wow, this was a real tough exercise, and I have learned within my own organization maybe what needs to be improved. how I'm able to better communicate with NERC and some of the federal partners, to include some of the intelligence agencies that are out there.
All right. Brian Harrell, thanks so much for your time. I'm reassured by how cheerful, optimistic, and confident you sound. I feel so much better than I did for most of the show. All right. We'll be back tomorrow with a nose. Thanks to Patrick Scahill. He's the guy who put this cheerful show together for you.
I'm Kyone Wolf. It's so cold. If only I could flip a switch and just turn the power back on. You guys, all we had to do this whole time was just flip the switch! The show could have been a lot shorter.